What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Me and my buddy are taking a canoe trip down the Kahuluwasee. We'd like our cars to be down in Aintree when we get there. Be there about Sunday noon.
What the hell you want to go F around with that river for?
Because it's there. It's there, all right. You get in there and can't get out, you're going to wish it wouldn't.
And what happens if Deliverance isn't in my top five nature movies?
How's your Ned Beatty impression?
Note to self, cancel canoe trip. Plus our review of director David Gordon Green's latest, Prince Avalanche, with Paul Rudd and Emile Hirsch. That and more.
Can you say Kahuluwasee one more time, Josh?
Ahead on Film Spotting. Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 700,000 high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level.
With our nature theme this week in the top five, I went to Shutterstock, Josh. I did a search for nature-related clips. You know how many I came up with?
360,000.
How'd you know?
I just guessed.
Yeah, it's amazing. Actually, 360,000 nature-related videos available on Shutterstock. And then if you even want to find nature-related photos, there's something like 42,000 more of those. For 30% off your new account, just go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM8. You're listening to Film Spotting. Josh and I have our banjos, our bows and arrows, and an irrational fear of sadistic mountain men, which means we're fully prepped for our top five nature movies coming up later in the show.
I think that's pretty rational, actually.
Absolutely.
But first, it's time for a Film Spotting deathmatch.
My name is Jordan Belfort. The year I turned 26, I made $49 million, which really pissed me off because it was three shy of a million a week.
We're making a name for ourselves.
Nobody knows if the stock is going to go up, down, sideways, or in circles. You know what a fugazi is?
Oh, Pugazi. It's a fake.
Hey, Fugazi, Fugazi. It's a wazi, it's a woozy, it's a fairy dust.
So we're having a little bit of fun this week. We're doing something different, Josh. We're actually beginning the show with our poll question. And you just heard there a clip from The Wolf of Wall Street, the new film from Martin Scorsese coming out, what is it, November probably, or maybe even December, I think, is when the film is slated for release. It stars Leo DiCaprio, who you just heard in that trailer, and it's about the rise and fall of an 80s stockbroker. We are going to do one of our patented film spotting death matches here. It's a simple poll question. We give you a setup. We give you two answers. You can only choose one. It's our fall preview edition, as next week on the show, we are planning to share our top five most anticipated fall releases. Some previous death matches here on the show include DiCaprio versus Damon. That was legendary. I think that came down to basically 50-50 all week, and DiCaprio just maybe snuck that one out by a few votes. And more recently, we did Back to the Future versus Die Hard. We also did J.J. Abrams versus Joss Whedon. I thought that would be a lot closer than it was. As I recall, though, I think Joss Whedon stole that one as well. So with that, what are their two options? You can only see one of these two fall movies. You can only pick one. Which one is it? What are their choices?
It's going to be The Wolf of Wall Street or Inside Llewyn Davis from the Coen Brothers.
So Scorsese versus the Coen Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Two of my favorite filmmakers. Two of your favorite filmmakers, Josh. I imagine most people listening probably revere these two filmmakers. Do you want to weigh in with the choice right now? Do you know which one you would go see if you could only go to one of those two films?
I would probably choose Inside Llewyn Davis only because, and this may be entirely unfair, but I feel like The Wolf of Wall Street is somewhat of a riff on Wall Street. I'm still excited about it. It looks fantastic. The trailer I love, but it does feel like familiar territory a little bit. And Llewyn Davis just sounds like, I don't know what to expect from it. Another Coen Brothers musical, perhaps, but the curiosity factor in that one is stronger for me.
You know what? You convinced me. I think I'm with you, because if it was just Coen Brothers versus Scorsese, I might actually choose the Scorsese film, almost as more of a prestige thing. You feel like you have to see his next film. But based on the fact that just the subject matter doesn't seem to interest me quite as much as not knowing what you're going to get from a Coen Brothers film. And Oscar Isaac is the star of that movie, and
right,
we both like a lot. So we're both going Coen Brothers, but we'll see how this one comes out. I have a feeling this one could be a lot closer than Abrams Whedon. We want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net.
Seriously, are you really cool not getting laid all summer?
I don't really have much of a choice, do I?
I mean, when you were out here for the spring by yourself, didn't you get lonely? Like, so lonely?
There's a difference between being lonely and being alone.
There is?
Oh, yeah. I reap the rewards of solitude.
How do you do that?
Well, I write letters to your sister. I read, I paint, I sew. I had a cat, so I used to take care of my pet before it was killed. I have a lot of prescription medications, but I try not to use them.
That's a scene from Prince Avalanche. Rather than playing a trailer there, Josh, as we normally would going into a review, I wanted to use that clip specifically. I was so grateful to find that that scene, So Lonely, was available online because it just seems so perfect with our top five this week as we're thinking about nature movies. And I just love the cinematic irony of Paul Rudd extolling the virtues of solitude, being out in nature, to a disbelieving Emil Hirsch, the same guy who played Chris McCandless in Into the Wild, the guy who was saying all those same things, but here can't believe what he's hearing. So that irony was pretty juicy for me, and I wanted to play that scene. As we said, Prince Avalanche is the latest film from writer-director David Gordon Green. It stars Rudd and Hirsch as highway road workers. I believe we can say this is backwoods Texas.
Yeah, that sounds right.
It's pretty desolate. In fact, they're recovering from fires that swept through the territory. They're just a two-man crew. Rudd is kind of Hirsch's boss. He also happens to be in a relationship with Hirsch's sister. The big, obvious, boring question, frankly, Josh, surrounding this movie, on some level, I'll acknowledge that, is whether it's a return to form for David Gordon Green. Is this the filmmaker who gave us George Washington, All the Real Girls, Undertow, and Snow Angels, modest, lyrical, often plaintive movies, or the filmmaker whose last three movies were Pineapple Express, Your Highness, and The Sitter, more explicitly comic, louder, and arguably dumber movies? And as I was thinking back on those first four films, it occurred to me that one of the connections there, besides the style, is that they all take place in these small towns. They're about small groups of people who are isolated. They seem cut off from the rest of the world, truly. And this film, Prince Avalanche, seems to be his most small, isolated group yet. We see a few people in passing briefly. They're really just there for show for a few minutes as they go by. We do meet two other characters. One of them very well may be imaginary. So for the most part, at least 90% of the screen time is just Rudd and Hirsch. And I think you could even make the case that it's almost a bit of a cinematic experiment for Green, where he's trying to see what he can do working within a set of limitations. Throughout the movie, we hear about all this activity that's going on with other people, what's going on in the city they have to drive a ways to get to. But Green clearly makes a decision to not show us any of that. We only see what's happening there at their camp or wherever they move to. So we only hear about that stuff. We only see what happens in this place. I'm curious if you think the experiment works.
I think it does feel like an experiment that I was on board with. It was an interesting melding. That's a fair and interesting question, I think, to ask, where does this fall? Because so many of us have been waiting for Green to, if not return to his early form, do something different than those broad comedies. Wasn't it on our top five directors who need a comeback list not too long ago? We both had him up there. So that's definitely a question that's worth putting to this film, even more so in retrospect, because I think one of the fascinating things about it is how it is melding, really, that early work of his with this comic sensibility he showed in the last couple of films. It's not an either-or thing at all. It's very much its own unique experiment. That's a good word for it. It feels like a play in a lot of ways, a little chamber piece. And I really appreciated how it had this bizarre bent to it, this taste for the surreal, definitely a comic sensibility. I mean, I would probably classify this mostly as a comedy. And a general haziness. You suggested how one character might be a ghost. I would even put out there, there's a chance that these two are the last two guys on Earth in some sort of post-apocalypse who are going through the routines of civilization just to keep the madness at bay. Yeah. There are just so many different realms going on here. You're never quite sure what level to take the movie at. And I say that as a good thing. Mm-hmm. It was a really enjoyable experiment for me.
Yeah. I certainly didn't think about it along those lines, the one character seeming more explicitly surreal or just not real. But there is that trucker character who we see who really only shows up two or three times to serve them alcohol.
Yeah.
Who you could make the case, maybe he's not really there. He's just sort of a foil. He's just there to cause some drama in their lives and to institute change or be a catalyst for change.
They almost seem to summon him up when they need him, you know, out of their own minds. I mean, these two guys are, I love the dynamic between them, the conversations back and forth. And I think you get this sense that they're creating this world together. So that's obviously kind of an outlandish reading of the film, but it's fun that the movie opens itself up to those sorts of things. I think at heart here, this is about two guys who are trying to deal in very different ways with the threat of responsibility or of society in general. I mean, the Rudd character very much wants to get, he's almost a survivalist. He's out there. He took this job so that he could be out of the city, live out in the woods, even on the weekends when he's not working. That's the appeal to him. And the Hirsch character, though he wants to be in the city, he's kind of the opposite to that degree. He's not any better as a member of the community when he's in the city because of the way he handles things like relationships or particularly sexuality. And they come back together and are both talking around the same thing, which is how to retain your individualism, your sense of your own identity, while still being a part of a community. And that seems to be the main tension that's at work here in the film.
Hey, Alvin, you know, I lied to you. I do have my eye on someone that's a girl.
Yeah?
Her name is Maggie Johnston. She's a total goddess. I've been working on her for a while.
Nice.
But I kind of messed it up, though. I lost her to my friend Kip, but I think they were on the road to splitting up if the way she was behaving last time I saw her at the dance club was any indication.
Problems in the relationship?
Probably by now.
Was she giving off signals?
Signals?
Yeah.
Well, she was making out with me in the toilet, if that's a signal.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the new film from writer-director David Gordon Green. It's called Prince Avalanche. We're in total agreement on this movie, including that element that we like about it beyond just maybe the sheer pleasure we get watching these characters. But I do want to focus on that a little bit because on its most base level, I just really enjoyed this movie. And what was a little bit confounding about it is if I really thought about it, I'm not sure I'd ever want to spend any significant amount of time with either of these people in real life.
No, probably not.
Right? I mean, you think about how Alvin is. They're not ready to spend time
with people.
You're right. They're not. But he's a little bit arrogant and just frankly annoying, and he's delusional. I mean, he has a sense of his place in the world and who he is in the world that, frankly, you can only scoff at, which Hirsch's character does.
Right.
And then at the same time, you have Hirsch, who's, you know, he's just such a goofball and really is very selfish and annoying most of the time that I wouldn't want to be around either of them for very long. And yet from the distance of my couch watching it on demand or watching it in the theater, I really did enjoy seeing them on screen. And I think for me, this is a credit to Gordon Green as a writer, but also to the two actors and their dynamic is that the funniest bits, they're all character based. It has nothing to do really with specific jokes or any obvious gags or set pieces. It's just about the interplay and how they interact with each other. So for me, like the funniest bit in the whole movie, the funniest line in the movie might be the one where Alvin, the Rudd character, says something about a chiropractor. And Emil Hirsch just looks at him, just totally deadpan, and says, "What's that?"
Right, right.
He's never heard the word chiropractor before, and he can't relate. He can't connect to him on that level. And that disconnection is something you see between them a lot. And it's really funny, but it does also get to this larger sense of how out of sync they are with each other and how out of sync they both are with this larger community.
See, and that reminds me of Pineapple Express, because that was a very broad pot comedy, but it was also quite rooted in character. And that's why it worked for me. There were some, you know, gags and obvious jokes as well, but it was the characters who made that story more than what it could have been. So clearly you have the humor in Prince Avalanche that we've seen in his more recent films, but you also have the lyricism that was the defining trait of his first couple of pictures. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this comes from the natural landscape, this really unique, charred out post-fire landscape that we have in the background where the trees, most of the trees are leafless, obviously, but also the bark is burnt away. And then there's new growth on the bottom of the forest floor. Mm-hmm. So that's just a really unique picture that's painted here. And it also gave it that, maybe that's why I went towards the post-apocalyptic thread and thinking what else right. might be going on here, because it has that sense when you look around. So it is a combination of that visual beauty that he was earlier known for and these little bits of comedy that are so fun.
Yeah, and there is something about that natural landscape and the fact that it's, for lack of a better first word that pops to mind, depressing, right? It is this burned out landscape. And so immediately it gives all of their interactions a little bit more resonance than maybe just watching two idiots out in nature. And I'm crediting to a large extent, as I said, the writer and director, but I think that Rudd and Hirsch are both very good here. And Hirsch is an actor who has annoyed me in several roles. Rudd's a guy I've liked quite a bit over the years, but he's decidedly very not Rudd-esque in this role. There are moments that you can see kind of fall into his stock personality, who he is, but there are a lot of scenes that are really underplayed by both him and Hirsch.
Yeah,
I'd
agree.
They clearly aren't going into their normal bag of tricks or trying to play up the humor. They really are just trying to relate to each other and can't relate to each other, and the humor comes out of that. So I credit them, but then on some level, I do wonder. I was thinking about our discussion of Elysium last week and how we noted, both of us, that some of the performances are just horrible, and you wondered if maybe Neil Blomkamp just hasn't developed that skill yet as a director, you know, where he really knows how to work with actors and actresses. And I do have to wonder if maybe we should give a little bit more credit to David Gordon Green, not just in how he shot these scenes, not just in how he envisioned it or how he wrote it, but maybe he did work with both of those guys a little bit and temper some of their instincts and drive them a little bit down the path that they go. But I think either way, however it was pulled off, the performances are a big reason why this film is so much fun to watch.
Without a doubt, you have to give him credit, because you look at his track record, and All the Real Girls, his second film, my favorite of his, mm-hmm. has Paul Schneider giving an amazing performance in the lead role there. Zooey Deschanel as well. They've both proven to be good actors in other stuff, but those performances carried that relationship film. So almost right from the start, yeah, his movies have had this hallmark of really rich performances.
Mm-hmm. When I watched this film, I have to admit that my first reaction when it was over was I liked it, but I really did see it as this modest little pleasure. Not a lot happens dramatically in it, and there's nothing profound really being explored, at least how I saw it on that initial viewing, but I thought it was absolutely entertaining enough. And then what I found, Josh, is that over the next 2 or 3 days, this movie really did linger with me. I could not get this movie out of my head, and it wasn't just the funny moments. It's certainly not conventionally dramatic, but there is something compelling about watching two very different people each recognize something in the other person, even if they don't know it, maybe on a conscious level, and then start to change. We see how Alvin loosens up a little bit and starts to take on a little bit more of Lance's personality. And similarly, Lance actually becomes somehow, by the end of this movie, a little bit of a more responsible human being. So there is that switch that I thought was interesting, because you have these people, as you've suggested, who are trying to find their place in the world. And at the beginning of the film, I think they both know their role. They feel pretty confident that they know what they're supposed to be doing with their lives, and they've got a set path. And what they find as they watch this film is that the path isn't really working for them. And we get some good drama out of that. But where it really came into focus for me, and I'm guessing a lot of people who enjoy this film would probably point to the same sequence, it's that bravura sequence at the center of this movie, where Lance is taken off to go back to the city, have a little R&R, and Alvin goes off on his own, and he's looking at the remains of a house that's burned down. And he encounters a woman, an older woman, who's roaming around the grounds, I believe looking for her pilot's license.
Right. Yep.
She claims she has a pilot's license somewhere, and she's looking around for that. So the whole thing's surreal right from the beginning. And then it gets even more surreal because of the style that David Gordon Green employs. It's a little bit like The Limey, I think of with Steven Soderbergh, though not quite as harsh with the cuts, but it's one of those cases where they're in dialogue with each other. They're saying things to each other, having a conversation. But a lot of times when the camera's on Paul Rudd, he's talking, but his lips aren't moving. Mm-hmm. He's not actually talking in that moment. So he's plucking sound from different moments in the conversation. And it does, again, take on this very ethereal, kind of ghostly sense about it. And that is a sequence that really, really locked me in. And what I realized, when you get to the end of it and you see this fantasy sequence play out with Rudd, where he kind of goes into what used to be the kitchen or the dining room area, and he enacts this fantasy of a 50s sort of ideal family scenario where the dad comes home from work and dinner's ready and he's talking to the kids or whatever. That's where it did start to occur to me that with this movie, beyond just the general sense of them trying to fit into a larger community, there is the specter of domesticity hanging over this whole movie, right? And I mean it figuratively, but also literally in the sense, I think you could argue that that woman is this ghostly type presence of domesticity where you really get amplified in those scenes, this conflict between personal freedom, you touched on that, but also this sense of responsibility. What kind of a man am I supposed to be? How am I supposed to exist in the world and what's expected of me? And we certainly see as the film goes on, Hirsch's character has to confront this head on. Circumstances sort of beyond his means or are now out of his hands really force him to confront that. And later in the film, I won't spoil anything, but there's a scene very near the end of the movie involving this woman and the trucker character that is really confounding in a natural, conventional plot or story sense. But when you think about it in terms of being this ghostly figure of domesticity, I think it makes perfect sense, actually.
Yeah, I think it does. I think you're onto something there. And what's interesting about that scene of Rudd, it's a pantomime he goes through in this burned down house, is that he's not quite mocking that sort of behavior. It's almost as if he's trying it out to see how it feels, because this is exactly the sort of thing he's fleeing from. So, yeah, that is a key sequence. And I'd also agree that this is a movie that lingers. I had a similar experience in that watching it, you're kind of left with, oh, that was a curiosity. I wonder what was going on there. And you don't expect to think much more about it. But the days afterwards, it comes back to you. We'll see how much potency it has as time goes by and in the eventual career of David Gordon Green. But for me, really refreshing to see something like this from him.
Well, Prince Avalanche is out now in limited release. It was playing here at the Music Box last week. And as of right now, I can't tell you whether it's going to stay over for another week. But we also saw it on demand. And I believe it is going to be playing via cable on demand for quite some time. So that's Prince Avalanche. If you get a chance to see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
It's time to play Massacre Theater when we come back. I'm not expecting a lot of entries, mainly because this is one of those movies people try to forget they've seen.
Well said.
Stay with us. I tried to complain, just to know what it could do. I had to try it again, just to give it a second chance. But it tore out my soul, passed out, crashed out on a mat. And that was the end of that. Well, lately, I've been such a drag, all down in the dumps, man, moping and dragging my feet, coping with a life of luxury. Focus on my defeats and all the things it sucks to be. Like the great one said, it's a cockroach crowd. And that was the end of that. Here we go. Wait, don't go. Distract me so you make it so easy. Hey folks, want to jump in here to remind you that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com, where you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project. They have over 700,000 high-quality stock video clips on Shutterstock, as well as 2D animations and 3D motion graphics. They offer a variety of digital formats, and most of them come in high definition. Shutterstock does review each video individually for the content and the quality before they add it to their library, and they add about 10,000 video clips each week so that every time you visit, you're going to find something new.
We'd love to hear from you out there. We know we have many listeners who use Shutterstock, a lot of very creative people, a lot of people who work for businesses that require the assets they get via Shutterstock. And just as we feature websites who use Squarespace and we like to feature your Audible recommendations, I'd love here to be able to include some of your testimonials for Shutterstock. And hey, you just might get your business plugged on the show. Just email those to feedback@filmspotting.net. We do remind you that Shutterstock has sophisticated tools so you can search and drill down by category, clip resolution, contributor, and more. They offer excellent customer service. They've got dedicated reps 24 hours a day throughout the week, and they offer flexible pricing so you can choose between individual clips or video packs.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like and save the video selections you make at your clip box. Once you do decide to purchase, use offer code FILM8 and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 30% off new accounts, use offer code FILM8. We thank Shutterstock for their support.
Wait, don't go. You turn me on so with your beasting lips and your pep the grinder hips like a thread and a needle. We're just typical people.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson with Adam Kempinar. That was The End of That by Plants and Animals, and it actually comes from the soundtrack to Drinking Buddies, directed by Joe Swanberg, and the stars of this are Olivia Wilde, Jake Johnson, Anna Kendrick, Ron Livingston, despite the fact that it stars Jake Johnson, my favorite actor of all time. I haven't seen it. You have?
I have.
Will this one get me on the Jake Johnson bandwagon?
I think it just might.
Yeah.
You really had a bad reaction to his performance in Safety Not Guaranteed.
Yeah.
I thought he was one of the best things about that film. But I know what you didn't like about his performance and the character he plays in Drinking Buddies. He is a brewer, and it takes place here in Chicago. Joe Swanberg, obviously a Chicago-based filmmaker. And they shot the film at Revolution Brewery, so it takes place in this craft beer setting. Olivia Wilde works there as well, and they're kind of best friends, but they clearly have a connection. They clearly have a romantic connection as well, but they're both also involved in relationships. And so that's really the central drama that plays out here, is kind of this will they or won't they scenario. Along the way, there's conflict with their significant others. Johnson is dating Kendrick, and Olivia Wilde is dating Ron Livingston. And then even Ron Livingston and Anna Kendrick get a little bit involved with each other at some point. But this is a film that, like a lot of mumblecore films, and he was one of the godfathers of that movement. We can debate whether or not this film falls into that genre, if that is even a genre that people are still working in. This is a film that really is not about what happens. There isn't any grand drama at work here. It really is, for me, the pleasure of this film was just about getting to observe these really natural, truthful, well-acted moments. It's by far the best thing I've seen Swanberg do, though I'll admit, in fairness, I've only seen two or three of his other movies. But this is a real step forward, I think, for him. And it does have an amazing soundtrack. The End of That, non-spoiler alert, is the appropriately closing song to the film. And I love the soundtrack. It may be even better than the movie, but I like the movie quite a bit. And I can recommend it. It's playing on VOD. You can rent it on iTunes and Amazon. And it's also playing here theatrically in Chicago. It opens this weekend. That's Drinking Buddies. And I do think, Josh, it might just make you come around on Jake Johnson.
All right, I'll check it out.
Completely different performance from Safety Not Guaranteed. Uses a lot of different elements to his own character as an actor, and I think he brings a lot to it that you'd respond to. As we're talking about acting and what makes a good actor versus a bad actor, I guess it's fitting that we move
Should
on
we
now
just demonstrate it?
To Massacre Theater, everybody's favorite part of the show.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam and I massacred this.
One day, lad, all this will be yours.
What, the curtains?
No, not the curtains, lad. All that you can see stretched out over the hills and valleys of this land. That'll be your kingdom, lad.
But mother.
Father, lad, father.
But father, I don't want any of that.
Listen, lad. I built this kingdom up from nothing. When I started here, all there was swamp. Well, the king said I was daft to build a castle on the swamp. But I built it all the same, just to show them. It sank into the swamp. So, I built a second one. That sank into the swamp. So I built a third one. That burned down, fell over, then sank into the swamp. But the fourth one stayed up. And that's what you're going to get, lad. The strongest castle in these islands.
But I don't want any of that. I'd rather...
Rather what?
I'd rather just sit.
Stop that. Stop that. You're not going into a song while I'm here.
That was Michael Palin as King of Swamp Castle and Terry Jones as Prince Herbert in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, directed by Terry Gilliam and Terry Jones, written, of course, by Monty Python.
We got this great email from Jerry Daly in Fayetteville, Arkansas. The tie-ins to your show last week, Dangerous Missions, was your top five, and they are bountiful. Just as Matt Damon in Elysium needs to break into the floating fortress up in the sky, John Cleese must take on an entire castle to save the fair maiden who is about to sing in your well-acted scene.
I really wish we had heard that. Oh, well. Jerry goes on, in fact, the quest for the Grail poses many dangers, ranging from insubordinate anarchist mud farmers, witches who weigh the same as ducks and therefore must be made of wood, knights who simply don't know when to quit, killer rabbits, beasts that can only be avoided through cardiac mishaps striking the animator, three-headed giants with bad breath, viciously mocking French soldiers with outrageous accents, diabolical questions like what is your favorite color, and overzealous police. Not to mention the cruel knights who say knee, who will torture with that dread word any who fail to satisfy their desire for two shrubberies, placed with one slightly higher to make a little two-level effect with a path running down the middle. But I digress.
A lot of listeners digressed in their email responses to Massacre Theater this week. It sounds a little bit like Jerry Daly has seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail, I don't know, 1, 2, or 67 times, as many of our listeners have. That was a fun batch of comments to read. We also heard from David Hill in New York City, who, Josh, pointed out 8 connections.
Wow.
8 connections. Might be a new record between our choosing Monty Python and the Holy Grail and our review last week of Elysium and our top 5 dangerous missions. I will say that we probably only actually thought of 1 of those connections.
That's usually the case.
But they're there, and some of them kind of spoil Elysium, so I'll just say the 2 we pointed out that I never would have thought of. It turns out, according to David anyway, that The Holy Grail was the sophomore film from the Monty Python gang. And, well, this was the sophomore film, Elysium, from Neil Blomkamp. And, of course, Holy Grail set in a different time period, just as Elysium is set in the future. So
this is true.
There is another
connection. I can see how he got to 8.
Thank you, David, for that. Yes, he was really reaching for some of them, but they are true nevertheless. If you want to hear that scene, and we really turned in some fine accent work.
Yes, we did.
I think by fine, I, of course, mean horrible. But it's funny, so many emails saying, oh, finally, Adam found a use for his girl voice, but I was playing a boy, wasn't I?
It doesn't mean it's not appropriate.
No, and I did go to my standard girl sort of falsetto.
Hey, if
there.
I can go to Chucky when I need it, you can go to the little girl voice.
Indeed. Again, that show, Top 5 Dangerous Missions and Elysium, can be found at filmspotting.net, or you can listen via iTunes. Reach into that brimming film spotting hat. Once again, not a record holder. I'm sorry. I feel shame for our film spotting listeners. We did not get a record number of entries, not even in the top 10, but a lot nevertheless. Josh, you reach in and pick out this week's winner.
The winner would be Kathy Zoli from McHenry, Illinois.
Congratulations, Kathy. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
Dracula requires presence. It's all in the eyes and the voice and the head.
That's right. That's right. You seem a little agitated. You want to go outside and get some air?
I'm ready now. Roll the camera.
Time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent, foreign, and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Help support the show by signing up now. Filmspotting listeners get the first 30 days free. This should be a fun one. We're going to set a record, I think, Josh, in the entire history of the show. The shortest Massacre Theater ever.
It is pretty short, so listen up or you'll miss it.
We may do it again just because it's so much fun to say.
We'll see.
And that's a little bit of a hint for you, actually. We'll also tell you by way of a hint that it does tie in directly, though you won't be able to tell from the dialogue. It ties in directly with our top 5 this week, nature movies. And I'm guessing a lot of people are actually writing in their answers right now on those hints without hearing a word we say. And maybe you shouldn't listen to a word we say because this dialogue is so, so bad, but so, so fun. You started off, Josh. I'm going to give you the action. Are you ready?
I am ready.
And action.
I hear you whispering, planning on stealing something.
No, ma'am, we're not.
Planning on murdering me in my sleep?
What? No.
And
scene.
Short and sweet.
There you go. If you know what film we just massacred, though, I don't know you can massacre that film, actually.
It is a case where we improved it.
We may have. Email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, August 26th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
I know the Back Harlow Road. It comes to a dead end by the Royal River. The train tracks are right there. Me and my dad used to fish for cossies out there.
Jesus Christ, man. If they would have known you were under there, they would have killed you.
Could he have gotten all the way from Chamberlain to Harlow? That's really far.
Sure. He must have started walking on the train tracks and just followed them the whole way.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And then after dark, train must have come along and all smacko.
Yeah.
Of course, Will Wheaton, River Phoenix, Corey Feldman, and Jerry O'Connell from Stand By Me, the Rob Reiner film. As we were looking ahead to this week's show, last week we knew we were going to be talking about Prince Avalanche, the latest film from writer-director David Gordon Green. It's a movie set in the summer of 1988. So we were reflecting back on summer as youths and as teens, and also cinematically as summer films is definitely its own genre. We're not thinking necessarily of Raiders of the Lost Ark or Lethal Weapon or some of those big tentpole summer movies, Jaws, Star Wars, but rather movies that are set in summer that evoke a sense of summer and your memories of it. We gave you actually six options. All you had to tell us was which of these movies best reflects your personal memories of summer. Your choices were Adventureland, Dazed and Confused, Dirty Dancing, Stand By Me, National Lampoon's Vacation, or Wet Hot American Summer from David Wayne and Company. How did it come out, Josh?
Dirty Dancing was put in the corner only 2%.
I can't say I'm surprised.
No?
But I really wanted to hear from some people who claimed that that was reflective of their summer experience.
Some good stories there. I bet. Yeah. Wet Hot American Summer also at the bottom here with only 4%. Maybe not a lot of camp counselors
campers,
in the listening audience.
I never went to camp when I was a kid, so I can relate.
National Lampoon's Vacation, 12%. That was my vote, but only 12% of the people joined me. Here in third place, Dazed and Confused received 25% of the vote, followed closely by Adventureland with 26% of the vote. But the winner was Stand By Me, 32%.
Yeah, and I can't say I'm surprised by that one. I think some of our comments here will help explain why. If I had to go back and re-vote in this poll question, I said Adventureland because I did actually spend a summer working at Adventureland and went to an amusement park like that quite a bit as a kid. Stand By Me is actually a better answer for me, Josh, because even though I didn't have adventures along the lines of going to look for a dead body, when I think back on my youth, I do think about summers riding my bike with my buddies, one of my friends in particular, Matt, getting into all sorts of trouble, doing things we shouldn't have been doing, riding our bikes miles out of town. And that probably really is the film that makes me think more nostalgically about my childhood.
I'm totally with you. And Joshua Gall wrote in from Saratoga Springs, New York, and his description, yep, that's what made it sound familiar to me too. He says, well, I would love to say something else, but I have to go with Stand By Me. My memories of childhood involve a lot of riding bikes with a few friends, walking around in the woods, going to the community pool, and just spending a lot of time outside doing nothing. I wish we would have done a lot more deep discussion that made us men, but it was more a lot of talk about baseball, Beavis and Butthead, and me pretending to love grunge rock at only 11 years old. We tended to look for dead bodies, too. Found a few. Don't tell anybody.
Your secret is safe with us, Joshua. Along those lines, it makes me think, too, Josh, about the fact that now I have an 11-year-old son who should be getting into some of the same mischief and doing a lot of those same things that Josh was writing about and that I was talking about, referring to when I was a kid. And I don't let him do any of those
things. It's not the same world, is it? Or we're not the same parents, is probably what it really is.
We're definitely not the same parents. And I think we're a lot more careful and maybe too careful, but I barely let him walk the dog around the neighborhood. I think back to the things that my buddy Matt and I used to do where no adult knew where we were for 8 to 9, 10 hours at a time.
We had the forest preserves here in Chicagoland. There was one a couple blocks from my house, and that's where we went all summer.
Jeremiah from Brooklyn says, I went with Adventureland, but not because I worked at an amusement park. Rather, like the Jesse Eisenberg character, I went to a fancy pants school and was depressed as hell whenever I came home for the summer to my podunk upstate New York hometown and wound up working a job that never had anything to do with the education my parents were paying through the nose for, pizza guy, comma landscaping. And obviously, had there been a foxy gal at any of those jobs, I have no doubts she would have gone for a jerk like the Ryan Reynolds character instead of awkward, well-meaning old Eisenberg slash me.
Here's a vote for Wet Hot American Summer. It comes from Taylor C. from Meriden, New Hampshire. As someone who has spent 5 of the last 6 summers as a counselor at a sleepaway camp, I had to go with Wet Hot American Summer. As irresponsible as the characters are in utterly implausible scenarios, there's an honesty to the attitude and spirit that could only have come from people who actually worked at camp themselves.
And this from Alex in North Melbourne, Australia. Oh, to be young and American. I really love these comments. Sadly, none of these films depicts my childhood. Instead, they seem to depict the films I was watching in my childhood. I wish mine was as blazed as Dazed and Confused, teenagers can drive before 18? What? Being able to go to this amazing thing called a summer camp, or to know the intense gaze of Johnny at a hideaway for loaded families? I had to pick Dirty Dancing in the end, as it was the childhood I wished was mine more than anything. Sadly, I think they are yet to make a film that is close to my childhood, probably because it would just be about a girl hanging out inside all day, watching films about America.
Oh, that's so sad.
It is, kind of. Thank you, Alex, for those insightful comments.
Nathan from Indianapolis suggested a film. A couple of people suggested this film, actually. He said, I find your lack of Sandlot disturbing. Also, John Nordyke from Corvallis, Oregon.
It is Oregon, Josh.
Thank
well
you.
Said.
I wanted a compliment on that. Nathan from Indy is 10 million percent. Is that the number here? Correct.
I believe so.
No Sandlot, really. What happened to Sandlot?
So Sandlot has come up once or twice here on the show, and I think that just missed my wheelhouse for nostalgia purposes. I think when that came out, I was maybe at the end of junior high or going into high school. And
is it that old?
I think it is. It's not a movie. Are you saying I'm old? Josh, how dare you? As you just tried to brush by that. But I think I missed that one. That was post Stand By Me, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, yeah.
And I was well out of sort of that phase where a movie like that probably would have really grasped me. I remember seeing it on TV, and I love baseball even, but The Sandlot was never one of those films, like for so many film spotting listeners who are, frankly, probably about 10 years younger than I am. It never resonated with me.
Yeah, the baseball thing wouldn't have caught my attention. And I think I want to see what the year is on that, actually, because I think it's relatively recent and I know it got a lot of good responses, mm-hmm. but I've never seen it.
You really haven't seen it?
I haven't seen it.
Wow.
Sorry.
Gasps of horror just went out among all of our 25-year-old listeners in Film Spotting Nation. Thanks to everyone who went to filmspotting.net and voted in that poll question and for including your comments in the poll. Thank you so much as well for following our instructions, including your location. Makes the segment so much more fun when we know where you're from and we can hear Josh pronounce Oregon correctly.
Woohoo!
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, hey!
Shots fired, fruit fair.
We're just trying to get home.
What is going on?
Next stop, Fruitvale Station.
Well, I got my plug for Drinking Buddies in earlier in this segment. Now it's time for another edition of Larson Recommends after the spectacular. Now, last week, we may need a catchier title and some
yeah,
theme
I think
music,
so.
But that's a clip from the trailer for Fruitvale Station, a movie that did come up on the show recently, though, Josh, I believe it was just in bonus content. Our friend from the Chicago Tribune, Michael Phillips, was here. We pinned him down in that bonus content to share his top five films of 2013 so far, and he's a really wily guy, and he didn't want to commit to a five down to one. But it sounded like Fruitvale Station might, in fact, be his favorite film of the year so far. I'll let you get into a little bit more details about the movie. Obviously, based on the title of the segment, you recommend it. Did you like it anywhere as close to as much as Michael Phillips?
Wow, probably not if he has it as his film of the year so far. I didn't realize he gave it 4 stars, but I was encouraged to seek it out after he spoke about it because it kind of surprised me that it was getting this sort of response just because it seemed like maybe this was going to be some sort of message movie. If you're not familiar with the story, this is a dramatization of a 2009 event in which Oscar Grant was shot and killed by transit police in Oakland, California, after he had been pulled off the train along with some friends, really for no reason. He was subdued at the time, and huge uproar over this, and a lot of echoes, obviously, also with the Trayvon Martin incident. And so it seemed to me this might be a message movie that maybe just offered an angry diatribe about this. That could have been one way this went. Or maybe it would be more of a clinical procedural that examined the details of the case. That might have been another way. And both of those are completely justifiable artistic responses to something like that. But for whatever reason, it didn't have me running out to see it. I should have gone right away because the director here, Ryan Coogler, making his first feature, takes a completely different approach that is the reason this movie works. It's a quieter approach. It's rather uneventful. It's simple. It's just following the 24 hours in Oscar's life before this incident. And all that we learn there is that this guy was human. I mean, that's the key takeaway from this, which should be obvious, but that's not what happens in the wake of these incidents. Often the figures are grabbed for various political purposes. So Oscar's either a saint who was an innocent who was slaughtered, or he was a hoodlum who, you know, probably deserved this anyway. Those are kind of the two narratives that emerge. And what gets lost is that this was an actual person who may have had some problems in his life. He may have had some nobility to him. And this movie, including a really phenomenal performance by Michael B. Jordan, captures all of that. So whatever you may think the movie is offering, chances are it's going to be a completely different experience for you.
That's Fruitvale Station, a movie I have been meaning to catch up with ever since I saw Michael's review initially and he came on the show. I have to admit, not only has it been a time issue, but subject matter-wise, one of those harrowing films that kind of turns you off a little bit, just in terms of not being excited to go dwell in that space and know where it's going to go and have such a sad ending. But it is nevertheless one I am determined to catch up with soon, and it is playing here in Chicago, I believe still in theaters, came out 3 or 4 weeks ago, but I know there are select theaters around Chicago that are showing it. Speaking of that, Josh, we once again have some movie passes to give away here on the show. There's a new film coming out called Closed Circuit. It stars Eric Bana and a film spotting favorite, Rebecca Hall. I believe it opens on Wednesday, August 28th, but you have the opportunity to see it the day before it comes out, and also for free, because we're giving away free passes to it. There's a screening at the AMC River East here in Chicago, and all you have to do is go to filmspotting.net. There's a link right in the top story section of our website. That's where you enter, and you may just get those free passes. Also wanted to throw out a plug for the great Gene Siskel Film Center here in Chicago. Josh, one of our favorite theaters, one of our favorite venues for art house cinema and independent releases, and they're doing something that I had thought about wanting to see if there was ever a theater that would do it. I'm sure others have probably done it, but it was something I was really curious about, if this opportunity would ever arise. And I don't think I'm going to be able to make it, but maybe some of our listeners, not just in Chicago, but in nearby communities, may be able to make it into Chicago and have a chance to experience this, because the Siskel is going to play the entire Before trilogy, the entire Richard Linklater, Julie Delpy, Ethan Hawke set of films, starting August 31st, I think, appropriately, there are three chances to catch it, but you can watch the films back to back to back.
So what are you committing to there? I don't think it'd probably be a full 6 hours,
no,
right? Because they're all under? Are they closer to 90 minutes?
No,
even,
I think
maybe?
They're all under 2 hours. I think the first two are under 90 minutes or just about.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not like we're watching the Lord of the Rings trilogy or anything. You can actually survive this one, and it is something, like I said, I would love to participate in, and I know many of our listeners would too. So if you weren't already familiar, that's playing at the Siskel Film Center, and all you have to do for more information is go to siskelfilmcenter.org/beforetrilogy. Along those lines, we're going to talk a little bit about Before Midnight finally in our bonus content this week. It's been, I think, 6 to 8 weeks since we discussed that movie here on the show, and we've been putting off the great feedback we got, but we're finally going to dive into it in our bonus content this week. This is the extra bit of audio you can get if you are a Film Spotting app subscriber. All the information you need about how to get that audio is available at filmspotting.net. Just click on apps, but you can get it if you have our app for iPhone, Android, or it's now available on the Windows 8 phone as well. Again, we're going to dive into your feedback on Before Midnight.
Inspired by the Discovery Channel series Naked and Afraid, Adam and I were dropped in a remote swamp and left to fend for ourselves until we came up with our lists of the best nature movies.
The best part of that is that you're aware of that show. I've never even heard of it.
I just discovered this weekend.
Did you?
Fantastic. Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
How do I know if I love you when I show
donation time here on the show is we get to our thank yous, and we do thank everyone who went to filmspotting.net or went to PayPal and sent some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. It really does keep us doing what we're doing, and we won't spend a ton of time this week. We only have three new donors we want to mention, but we do have as well a lot of monthly subscribers, Josh, who are the lifeblood of the show. Some $2 a month holdovers still, but there's a lot of $5 a month and $10 a month subscribers who we don't mention every week, but thank you to everyone who is part of that donation subscription plan. We'll start with a new $5 a month donor.
That would be Chad from Binghamton, New York.
We'd also like to thank Zach in East Brunswick, New Jersey.
Least I could do after listening to the show for 6 years since I was 13 years old. I'm 19 now, and I still listen every week.
13 years old.
I don't think they have to pay if they're 13, right? That should be.
We do have one final donation, Josh, that isn't on your sheet because it was sent to our P.O. box. And we've got some interesting comments here, some funny comments, and I'll try to pull them up on the computer screen here because I forgot to print it out. But we got an email and a letter via our P.O. box from a listener named Richard Lusk. And first, Richard went about scoring the film Spotting Fights Revisited between Adam and Josh. He scored it like a boxing match.
Really?
I don't know if you've seen this, but he broke down each battle, and I'll just summarize it here. Starting with Prometheus, he did score it for you.
Okay,
10-9.
Makes sense.
And then even though it seems like he's kind of on your side with Argo, he liked the fight I had in me, and he does give that round to me. We're now tied 19-19.
Good effort on that
is what
he's saying.
Thanks. That is basically what he's saying. I'll take it any way I can get it. Round three, we go to The Impossible. He gives that one to you just slightly. You're now back in the lead 29-28. But then there is a final round that wasn't part of that fight show, but could have been.
Yeah, I don't remember a final round.
The Pacific Rim show. And
okay,
that was a good battle. And we come out of that one. We go to the scorecard. It is 38 Larson, 38 Kempinar.
Oh, come on.
A draw.
Come on.
He says it's a draw. And
pick
he congratulates both of us. He should really pick a side, but I'll take that one. He also said he's not really in a position right now to donate to the show, which is great. Totally fine. And he says, though, he's going to send a few small tokens our way. So I go to the P.O. box and I find a letter in there. And there are 5 Barnes & Noble gift cards.
Oh, wow.
And they are for me, you, but also for Sam, Candace, and Golden Joe Dassault.
How thoughtful.
The entire Film Spotting team he donated a gift card to, and we really do appreciate that. He also, tying in with Elysium, mentioned that he has a real fondness for the Ursula Le Guin short story, The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, and he printed that out and included that in his letter. I've read that one. It's a great short story. I want to say it was maybe part of a literary analysis class I had to take as a freshman studying English at Grinnell. I think that was a story we read maybe even my senior year in high school. So it's a great story. I agree with you completely on that. And Richard, we thanks for the fun you have with the show, the fun you had with that email and your breakdown of our battles.
I await his score on our Elysium discussion.
Yeah, I want to hear it as well, because I'm trying to see, looking at his comments here real quick, whether or not he came down one way or another. He doesn't make that clear.
He's got to get
Elysium
to that yet.
So we'll have to hear from him on that. Thanks again to Richard, to Chad, and to Zach for your donations. A quick note, since we do have a little bit of extra time here in this donation segment, one of our longtime listeners and one of our Film Spotting Advisory Board members, Sarah Staggs, sent in this note having recently moved to the Denver area from Cincinnati, and she got in contact with another Film Spotting listener who is a big fan of the show and just recently moved to that area. I want to say it's Kenny Meyer, our longtime supporter from Palm Desert, California?
That sounds right.
Yeah, but now he's in Denver. And she says, I know he's anxious to meet other film spotters in the area, so if you could, the next time you record, maybe mention it on the show and direct people to the forum to check out the film spotters in the Denver/Boulder area. I know that he would really appreciate that, and it would be cool for me to meet some new people as well. So I know we've got listeners in the Denver area. We have listeners in a lot of locations. And the best place to go if you want to try to connect with other film spotting listeners would be to the Film Spotting Forum. There's a section for local events and meetups, and you just might find some people you want to get together with, maybe just have a drink, maybe go watch a movie, maybe you start your own film weekly festival or your own kind of marathon and your own cinema club.
Who knows?
That'd be fun too. We love hearing from those people. So thanks, Sarah, for reminding us to share that note. Finally, we do want to share a quick plug for our buddy Jeff Goldsmith and his podcast, The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith. Great interviews over there with screenwriters. In depth, they're always over an hour long, and you can check out what Jeff has going on this week by going to iTunes and just doing a search for The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, or you'll find a direct link in the notes for this show on our website, filmspotting.net.
Hi, this is Martin McDonagh. You're listening to Film Spotting.
I'm out in the prime cut of the Big Green. Behind me is Ed and Rowdy, members of an up-and-coming sub-adult gang. They're challenging everything, including me. Goes with the territory. If I show weakness, if I retreat, I may be hurt, I may be killed. I must hold my own if I'm going to stay within this land. For once there is weakness, they will exploit it, they will take me out, they will decapitate me, they will chop me into bits and pieces. I'm dead. But so far, I persevere. Persevere.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh, and if you're going to talk about nature movies, as we are this week with the Film Spotting Top 5, inspired by our discussion earlier in the show of the new David Gordon Green film, Prince Avalanche, then you gotta play a clip coming in from Werner Herzog, Mr. Nature himself. No filmmaker probably deals with nature and that conflict between man and nature more than Herzog. The only other one might be Terrence Malick. That was a scene from Herzog's Grizzly Man, and we could have picked a clip from so many Werner Herzog films, Josh, and that's why, actually, we did give ourselves a rule, a restriction this time here
a
on
ban.
The show. A ban. We banned Werner Herzog films and Terrence Malick, just to make it a little bit more interesting.
For the record, my pick would have been Grizzly Man for Herzog.
Okay.
Probably Thin Red Line for Malick.
Yeah, I could see that. I wouldn't have gone with Thin Red Line because it's not one of my favorites, but so many of his movies, Badlands, Days of Heaven, those are nature movies to the wonder, which you like more than I do. Tree of Life, you could argue. And then look at Herzog. I mean, not just Grizzly Man, which I do love, but Fitzcarraldo, A Gear of the Wrath of God, Little Dieter, Rescue Dawn, Cave of Forgotten Dreams, Encounters at the End of the World. You can really go on and on. I'd even mention a film called Lessons of Darkness, which is an experimental movie where he goes and shoots the oil fields of Kuwait after the Iraq conflict ends there. So a lot of stuff we could have gone with, and that's why, again, we chose to leave off both Herzog and Malick. We also gave ourselves one more out. We exempted one other film. This is, of course, the Sharknado Memorial List. Wait, I'm sorry. It's the
I knew that was going to come up.
Into the Wild Memorial List, a movie we do both really appreciate, starring Prince Avalanche co-star Emil Hirsch, directed by Sean Penn. One of those films that I don't know that it would be above some of my other films on my list in terms of how much I love it, but when I think of nature movies and a character going out into nature, truly looking for all the answers, thinking that's going to bring him some sort of revelation on how he should be leading his life, Into the Wild's the go-to movie. So we threw that one aside.
My top film of 2007, so
really?
It would have been pretty high up on my list.
I think it was actually in my top 10.
Nice.
I think it was my number 7 or 8 of that year. So we're mostly in agreement there on Into the Wild, and that does bring us finally to our top 5 nature movies. Josh, what's your number 5?
Number 5 is Uncle Boon Mi, Who Can Recall His Past Lives.
Directed by who?
This is directed by Apichapong Wirasethakul.
Yeah, close enough.
Let's go with it. Comes from 2010. That is the Thai director. And there
you
is a
Joe.
Huge, I'll call him Joe
yeah,
from here on out, just to make
says.
Things a little easier. There's a huge cultural gap here. I will admit it. In watching this film, I have no grasp entirely on what's going on or what the cultural references are. But what's clear is that the story is intimately tied and connected to our relationship with nature. The central story centers on an older man who's dying of kidney complications at his country home, and this lies just outside on the edge of the jungle. We're told that the spirits of the forest can sense his sickness somehow and are being drawn out into the human world because of this. And a couple of these spirits that we see, one is of his late wife. She makes this slow apparition appearance at the dinner table that's actually kind of romantic. And then there's also his long-lost son, who appears as this ape-like creature with these violently red eyes. Now, the weird thing is none of this is very scary, actually, especially given Joe's languid, dreamy filmmaking style. If I was going to compare this film to anything and how it feels and how it looks and how it moves, really, I would compare it to something in nature. It sort of imperceptibly droops like a heavy frond. So this is a bizarre movie, and you won't get your arms all the way around it, but still a really worthwhile experience.
Yeah, I agree. I agree absolutely. It's a very challenging film, but nevertheless, just some of the imagery is so striking that I agree it had to be considered for this list. I'm glad to see it make your top five. My number five could be higher, but I'm going to leave it here in that last spot, really, because it's my slipperiest pick. It's the one that I feel like maybe has the least direct tie to nature, but I'm going to try to make a case for it nevertheless. It is the Abbas Kiarostami film, Taste of Cherry. It's about a man named Badi who is looking for someone to bury him and he's on a quest. And he encounters three different men who he basically tries to recruit to bury him when he's dead, which seems imminent. And most of it takes place in a car driving around a suburban area, which I suppose is technically nature. And they are taking in the outside world, but it's not a jungle or a forest. It doesn't feel natural like a film like Uncle Boon Mee does. But Kiarostami does frequently feature their surroundings, and he uses a lot of long shots and overhead shots of the car moving through these hills, and it does get out more in nature the further they get away from the city. And one of my favorite sequences in the movie is this work site, but there are these huge mounds of sand, and there's something really evocative about that entire sequence and those mounds of sand. But it's not only those shots and some of the injury that makes it stand out for me, Josh, as a nature film. It's also what's at the core of the movie, Badi's desire to be buried. He wants to die, but he's not willing to die without being covered up and put in the ground. And we can talk about why that is. Maybe there are some religious implications. The movie, as I recall it, it's been a while since I've seen it, but I don't think Kiarostami really delves into the reasons why he may feel that obligation or feel compelled to do it. But as you watch the film, it just makes sense. There seems to be a logical connection between man and nature and him wanting to be put in the ground. Also, if you look at the poster for this film, the key image from this movie is a tree. And I won't spoil what happens, but you do get an explanation at the end for the title of the film, why it's called Taste of Cherry, and where that tree imagery comes in and why it has such a profound symbolic image. But that all really reinforces the significance of that man and nature connection again. So even though, like I said, it's a little bit slippery because so much of it takes place in a car, when I thought of nature movies, it really is one of the first films that popped into my head.
I'll allow it, but it might fit better in a category of top five landscape movies,
yeah,
which maybe we can get to at
Absolutely.
Some point. But all right, my number four is Them, a giant radioactive ant movie from 1954 with an exclamation point in the title,
right,
no less. Makes it even better.
What is it? Species appears to be Camponotus ficinus, one of the family Fomicidae, an ant.
An ant? I don't believe it. It's not possible.
Now, two fears are coming together here in this picture. It's the fear of nuclear power. These creatures are the result of underground tests, but also the fear of nature and specifically insects that just about everybody has. This is a 50s sci-fi giant creature feature, so it has moments of silliness. The ants, I'll admit, they often look like these styrofoam balls loosely connected together. Giant styrofoam balls, of course. But the movie has an eerie production design that I think is a distinguishing feature for it. The ant queen's foggy, egg-strewn chamber, it predates a very similar setting that we get in Alien. And there are other nice touches in this movie that do help it to stand apart. So in this world of giant creature features, you could do a lot worse than Them.
Was that the 1950s, you said?
1954.
1954. Well, I see you're 54, and I raise you 1922 for my number four pick. I'm going all the way back to the film that most people consider the first real feature documentary, and it's Nanook of the North by director Robert Flaherty. It's shot in northern Quebec, Canada in 1920 and 1921, came out in 22, and Flaherty set out on this mission to document the Inuit way of life. So we get these Eskimos, we meet Nanook and his child and his wife, even if it was maybe not his real wife, and the people that he oversees here, and really see how they survive in this frigid environment, how they eat, how they build shelter. There's a famous sequence where we see them building their igloo that Flaherty had to stage because there wasn't enough light inside the igloo, so they kind of had to build it facing out towards the camera. Also, of course, I mentioned how they get food. There's another very famous stage sequence, the walrus hunt, that's really dramatic, and really you see for a documentary the early signs of narrative film. There were other narrative films at the time, but kind of what we've come to define as an action movie sequence. It very much feels like that. And Ebert wrote about this movie. He said the film was not technically sophisticated. How could it be? With one camera, no lights, freezing cold, and everyone equally at the mercy of nature. But it has an authenticity that prevails over any complaints that some of the sequences were staged. If you stage a walrus hunt, it still involves hunting a walrus. And the walrus hasn't seen the script, which I just love that line. It's so true. What shines through is the humanity and optimism of the Inuit. It actually makes me think of the work of Werner Herzog on some level, and Errol Morris, and the new film, The Act of Killing, where it isn't just interested in the facts. It's not about the truth of the Inuit life down to the letter. It's more about the spirit of truth as Flaherty perceived it, and he really saw there being a tragedy in the loss of this culture as it became more modernized and more infiltrated with Western means and Western technology. So he set out to to capture this. And it's something anthropologists have come to call salvage ethnography. He's trying to salvage this way of life forever. And I think he does it in a way that justifies, I would ultimately argue, the staging of some of the sequences, even if it doesn't seem pure to documentaries. I will just say this in closing about Nanook of the North, that because I recently taught at the University of Chicago a documentary class called Cinema Verite and the Problem of Truth, I had to start with Nanook of the North. And one of the things I was really curious about was whether the film would really have any resonance for modern viewers. It did for me when I saw it, but a class full of people ranging in age from 20 up to 65 and beyond, would they see this and actually care at all about Nanook or find this way of life fascinating and be swept up in it? And to a student, everybody at the end did. They all had
a really wonderful experience. The further away you get from a life like that, that could be. I might get to a documentary myself, actually, as we move along here. For now, though, I'm going to go to animation with The Lion King. Now, Bambi is probably the Disney picture that deserves to be on this list, but I had it not too long ago. I believe it was our top five stormy weather movies. So wanted to go with The Lion King here, the 1994 musical riff on Hamlet. It's not a bad substitute for Bambi, actually. The approach to nature here, though, it's not quite as naturalistic as what we find in Bambi. The animation is a bit more cartoonish, but it does have a decent balance, as Disney movies usually do, between the usual anthropomorphic characterizations that we think of immediately and figures that are somewhat more feral. And that's maybe why one of my favorite characters in The Lion King is the baboon Rafiki, because he still has that animal element to him more than some of the others. And I also appreciate The Lion King for giving me a shorthand that I can use with my kids whenever, you know, we come across some fact about nature that's really disturbing. I think last week it was something about how orca whales will kill baby whales while they're trying to migrate. That was a rough one, and I can just say, hey, circle of life.
There you go.
And it works.
I'm sure when something really bad happens, you just say, Hakuna Matata.
Well, sometimes
that
too.
And they accept that.
Yes.
Well, I'll see your animated pick for number three and go with an animated film as well for my number three, and it's the Hayao Miyazaki film Princess Mononoke. To give you its nature bona fides, Josh, if you will, there's a demon in the form of a boar god who's really upset because there's an iron ball lodged in its body. There's a prince named Ashitaka, he's our hero, who's seeking out the great forest spirit. There's a wolf clan and a wolf goddess. The title character is raised by the wolves, and there's a place called Iron Town, run by Lady Eboshi, who built the town by cutting down the forest. So yes, there is very clearly an environmental
you've got it covered
message
there.
Here going on. Everything bad that happens could be traced back to human greed and disregard for nature and use of its resources. And I just love with this film that opening sequence with the demon boar and later the boar attack on the Iron Town. Those are just absolute stunners. I just love the way the boar is depicted, the way it's drawn. It's really menacing and really kind of scary, actually. But I also just love with all of Miyazaki's films, and you certainly could have picked other Miyazaki films than Mononoke.
Sure.
It's the one that stood out for me of the ones I've seen, and I've only seen four or five, so I'm probably deficient here a little bit. But I do just love the complexity of Miyazaki. There are broad themes, and yes, they can be children's films. They really are ostensibly children's films, but they're also adult films because they really challenge the audience. It's not always clear, and I'd say Mononoke is one of the least clear in terms of its character motivations, or as a viewer really understanding from scene to scene who is good or who is bad, who you're rooting for or shouldn't be rooting for. And you don't necessarily get, by the end, a triumphant ending, this sense that you get with so many animated films, The Lion King, I think you could say, for better or worse, where everything is right with the world and everything is happy. That really isn't the sense. With Miyazaki, it's always the sense that, okay, there's some happiness. We've resolved this conflict. But this war between man and nature is going to wage on forever.
The circle of life doesn't really explain everything.
No, it doesn't.
And
you know, Hakuna Matata doesn't have much of an impact either. But there's just this sense with Miyazaki of inevitable human corruption lingering as it relates to nature. So Princess Mononoke, my number three.
My number two is my documentary. It's Microcosmos. I've spent a lot of time on fantastic representations of nature in this list so far, so I wanted to get to the real thing a little bit. And this suggestion came on Facebook, actually, from Paco Casablanca. It's a movie I was aware of. It was acclaimed when it came out. For some reason, I just never got around to it. This French filmmaking team, they use these lenses that are able to capture insects in really incredible, intimate detail. They also employ a lot of time-lapse photography and slow motion. And what it does is it turns this average meadow is really where most of this is taking place, becomes this otherworldly fantasia. I talked recently about the documentary Leviathan, which is set on this shipping vessel, and how it creates drama out of really everyday workman-like occurrences. And something similar happens here, so that we get this Beatles Sisyphean struggle to roll a ball of dung up a hill. And you're just engrossed in this, especially when it gets stuck on a twig. And you feel really bad for the guy at that point. I mean, I'm a sucker for these nature documentaries. I could really watch these all day long, but especially those that do manage to envision the natural world in a completely new way. And that's certainly what happens here.
Well, I have to feel shame because I've not seen Microcosmos, and then I'm going to feel even more shame, Josh, and I know you're going to let me have it. As I get to something I haven't done in a long time here in a top five, I'm going to cheat for my number two. I do have a cheat. I just couldn't leave it off. I could not leave off this trilogy of films. I'm going to focus on, I promise I'm only going to focus on one of them.
I thought we were going to try to keep this segment short.
And give a little bit of a nod to another film. I'll talk fast, I promise. But I had to include the Oregon Trilogy from Kelly Reichardt. Those three films being Old Joy, Wendy and Lucy, and Meek's
Just
Cutoff.
Just pick one.
If
Just
I pick one, I'm going to. Meek's Cutoff would be the one
Thank
I would
you.
Pick. But here's the thing. I actually think the film that I want to talk about, the one that would have definitely made this list even on its own, Josh, and that's why I feel comfortable cheating, is Old Joy. It's the first film. It's a movie about two estranged friends. They're named Kurt and Mark. Kurt is kind of a lost soul, seems more or less homeless, doesn't really know what he's doing with his life, pretty flaky. Mark is soon to be a father, has a wife at home, is trying to become a little more stable, and they reunite and they spend a weekend camping in the Cascade Mountains of Oregon. The film begins with a bird chirping, for crying out loud, and the whole running time takes place out in nature. And our friend Scott Tobias, formerly of the AV Club, now at the Dissolve, says, for a few lyrical stretches in Kelly Reichardt's beautiful Old Joy, there's a sound you rarely hear in American movies, silence, or at least the gentle assertions of nature when people aren't yapping over it, which I think is very well said by Scott and does sum up what works about this film so well, and also why it makes so much sense as a top five nature movie. I do think the trilogy gets progressively better. I like Wendy and Lucy more as a film than Old Joy, and I like Meek's Cutoff even more, but Old Joy really is about that connection to nature and how it's at odds with these characters and their connection to each other. There's a sequence at the end of the film where they get to this hot spring, which really is the culmination of the whole movie, and that is what I was keeping in mind as I was thinking about nature movies. So I've got a great quote here from a listener, Jefferson Hyde in Seattle, who has a great case to make for Meek's Cutoff, Josh, but we'll have to save it for feedback at some point. Old Joy and the Oregon Trilogy, my number two.
Yeah, that's the right pick out of those three. At least you chose the right film. Number one, I'm going back to a fantasy take on nature, and it's with the Eighth Wonder of the World himself, 1933's King Kong.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, before I tell you any more, I'm going to show you the greatest thing your eyes have ever beheld. He was a king and a god in the world he knew. But now he comes to civilization, merely a captive, a show to gratify your curiosity. Ladies and gentlemen, look at Kong, the eighth wonder of the world.
I think our fascination with nature partly comes from the fact, and this depends on whether it's the weather or landscape or animals themselves, nature is often something we can't control. So we feel small in the face of it. Now, some movies will capture the wonder of this. I think that's what Malick does quite a bit. And maybe here's the Herzog aspect. Some capture the fear of this or the horror of this. And the horror approach often will chronicle the misguided hubris of our attempts to control nature. And I think King Kong, it might be the granddaddy of these sorts of pictures.
Timothy Treadwell and Grizzly Man, to go back to
there
where
you
we
go.
Started.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I just love this movie so much. Right now, it's sitting in my top 20 of all time. So if you've never seen it because you feel like you know it, you know what it's about, you know how it looks, it's worth a sit through, definitely.
Well, that brings us to my number one nature movie as you're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. And this is a movie I just caught up with finally to prepare for this top five. It clearly had an impact. I don't see how after seeing it, it couldn't be my number one. It is Koyaanisqatsi.
Oh, did you check it out?
Yeah, nice. I did. I finally had to see it, especially because friend of the show, Sam Smith, who we recently mentioned, he loves this film and also the entire Cotsy trilogy. I didn't go with the whole trilogy. Didn't
no,
have time, so.
You're not going to include those all as your number one.
I'm not going to cheat.
That would
there.
Put you up to like 15 films on this top
but
five.
This 1982 film, how dare you, that's called Koyaani Scotsy, Life Out of Balance is the full title. It's directed by Godfrey Reggio. Music, great music, composed by Philip Glass, and the cinematography by Ron Frick, or Ron Fricky. I'm sorry, I have to confess, I'm not exactly sure how it's said. But the movie is basically a lot of slow motion, a lot of time-lapse footage of landscapes and cities. I mean, it's everything you could imagine in nature. Nature in its totality is captured over the running time of this film. There's no dialogue. There's no narration. It really is just images and music and the way the director juxtaposes those stimuli. And it does all fit together, as you would expect it would. They find the connections between the little things in nature and the big things in nature, and just the way an object moves or a creature moves or whatever it might be, or the way we perceive a building as it stands in nature. And what I do really love about the film is that as you watch it, it's very easy to look at it and think that, well, they're making some kind of obvious environmental statement here about how technology is infringing on nature and we've let it run amok and it's this really bad thing. And I'm not sure that the filmmakers don't feel on some level that there's something negative about how much we've let technology impose on our life. But I also think that they've just come to terms with it. And what the film really shows is just how integrated it is into everything we do. There really is no longer a delineation between nature and technology or modernity or whatever we think of as man encroaching on nature. It is one. And they really, really understand that. And I think that is what you get over the course of this film. So I think not only was that interesting to me, but in a larger sense, as I thought about nature movies, as I suggested, I don't think you get nature any more clearly. You don't get it in any more of a whole all-encompassing form than you get it in this film. And I really want to see the other two movies now.
There is something about the lack of narration that works for these type of films. Microcosmos works that way too, without any narration. There's a little bit at the beginning and a little bit at the end, and it's almost letting nature speak for itself, and that's plenty.
And that's what they're doing. I mean, they're letting us draw our own conclusions about whether or not this is a good or a bad thing that we see the way technology and nature come together. So those are our top five nature movies. Josh, what about any honorable mentions?
Well, my number one movie of last year certainly qualified, Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Yeah, I thought for sure
talked about
your
that
list.
Quite a bit recently.
Yeah, actually,
so.
I just shocked you under the table. Didn't you feel that?
Yes,
I still have that set up, the buzzer.
That's why I only mentioned it once here. A number of movies that I've mentioned on recent top fives that I would have loved to put on this list, but I set them aside. Jaws, Never Cry Wolf, Where the Wild Things Are, and The Black Stallion. And then here are three others, Jerry and two documentaries, The Cove and March of the Penguins.
Okay, all good picks. Jerry, I have to confess to still being, despite my love for Gus Van Sant, one of my blind spots. So
okay.
I want to acknowledge Jerry being a blind spot. I feel really, really guilty about that as well, considering that you can't watch Prince Avalanche. And
yeah, there are a lot
Jerry.
Of connections.
Even though I haven't seen it, I know the storyline of Jerry, and you see these two guys stuck together out in nature.
It came
seemingly
to mind
going
quite
nowhere.
A bit during Prince
yeah,
Avalanche.
Yeah, you have to think of Jerry. So if there was ever a time to catch up with it, I chose Koyaani Scotsy instead to catch up with some other films I did consider. Recent film that we both like quite a bit, The Gray. Picnic at Hanging Rock, the Peter Weir film.
Yeah, sure.
I did think about Brokeback Mountain. I don't know how you can't. It's there in the title. Granted, you could debate how much of the film takes place out in that space, but it's such a crucial part of the film. I thought about Land Without Bread, the Luis Buñuel documentary. It's only something like 20 minutes long, but really fascinating. And I also thought about The Edge. This is a David Mamet written film.
Yeah, I've never seen that
with
one.
Alec Baldwin and Anthony Hopkins. And you've got two guys, maybe because it wasn't directed by Mamet, who take his great dialogue and they really live it. They really make it sing. And it's fun to watch those two actors, those two heavyweights go up against each other. I think The Edge is actually maybe a little bit of an underrated film. And finally, I at least have to throw out a mention for Kurosawa. I think you can go to so many films.
Sure.
But Ron, I think about Throne of Blood. I think about how so much of that takes place in a castle, but the trees, all the shots of the trees and how spooky they are. The forest is such a key part of so many of his films. Rashomon. I mean, you could make the case that that's not just a film about human nature, but about nature as well. So had to at least throw out the name Akira Kurosawa. And that does it for our top five. We want to know your picks. You can send those to feedback@filmspotting.net along with any other comments about the show.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. or find us on Twitter at Filmspotting and at Facebook.com/Filmspotting.
Out in limited release this weekend, Ain't Them Body Saints, directed by David Lowery, stars Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. They're outlaws on the run in 70s-era Texas hill country. Seems appropriate as well with Prince Avalanche. Austin Land is out, starring Kerry Russell. She's obsessed with a BBC production of Pride and Prejudice, and they go to a Jane Austen theme park. I have to say, maybe it's just because I like Kerry Russell so much. I just find her so fun to watch. She's so adorable naturally on screen that maybe that's one I actually want to see.
That's the draw for you here?
It might be.
For me, it's the fact that Jerusha Hesch, who's directing Napoleon Dynamite, and even better, Nacho Libre for me.
Oh, man, you would say that. Of course you think Nacho Libre.
There's a tenuous connection to Nacho Libre. I'm in.
Oh, man. Also out, Drinking Buddies, the film set here in Chicago, shot here in Chicago by Chicago filmmaker Joe Swanberg, stars Olivia Wilde and my guy Jake Johnson. It is one I recommend. Out in wide release, You're Next. This is a horror film from one of the directors of VHS, Adam Wingard. It also includes, in the cast, director Joe Swanberg and Ty West, who appears as an actor in Swanberg's film Drinking Buddies. The World's End is out. This is director Edgar Wright. Five friends reunite for a pub crawl and become humankind's only hope for survival. I love it because if you were going to pick the ultimate kind of British dream cast, you would pick Simon Pegg, you'd pick Nick Frost, you'd go Martin Freeman, mm-hmm. Patty Considine. And who am I leaving
Eddie
out?
Marson.
Eddie Marson. There, yeah. There you go. I mean, that is the murderer's row of English actors. So that's one we are definitely excited to see. And that is the film we plan to discuss next week on the show. And we're going to share our top five most anticipated fall movies.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our featured music this week comes from the Drinking Buddies soundtrack. Features two bands, Here We Go Magic and Plants and Animals. You can find out more about them at herewegomagic.tumblr.com and at plantsandanimals.ca. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Should we do it one more time?
Why not?
Why not? Here we go. And action.
I hear you whispering, planning on stealing something.
No, ma'am. We're not.
Planning on murdering me in my sleep.
What? No.
And scene. I think you got it that second time.
I may have hit it that time. It's the what?